What's up, guys, and welcome to episode 2 of the Way of the Warrior podcast. I am your host, Coach Az. I run a kickboxing school here in the UK. So if you're a first-time listener, welcome. If you're a returning listener, welcome. Can I start by saying a huge thank you to all the positive feedback I received on episode 1? I'm still very much trying to work out, you know, as you do when you start new things, what I'm doing with my YouTube channel, who I want to reach, what message I want to put across, what kind of content I want to create. And the way I find out what people enjoy and what I do well is by the feedback you give. So when you send me these messages and let me know that you enjoyed it, that you're looking forward to episode 2, just thank you. It's very encouraging. I do it for me, not for the feedback, but it's nice to know that what you're doing is appreciated. So thank you. Let's start there. I've named the podcast now, the Way of the Warrior podcast, related to the club name, Warrior Martial Arts, related to the YouTube name, Warrior Martial Arts. It reminded me of a question I get asked all the time. And the question is, why did you call your club that? Why did you call your club Warrior Martial Arts? And although they don't often say it, what people are really asking is, why did you choose such a generic name? Because, you know, Google Warrior Martial Arts, see how many schools you find. They're not all mine, for sure. Everyone and their mother is called Warrior Martial Arts. This was my thought process. So a lot of martial arts schools are named after their lineage. So Gracie Jiu-Jitsu schools, Jackson Wink, MMA, you get the idea. I really didn't like the idea of using my name, not because I don't feel like I have a legitimacy, I do, especially within my own sport, but it just felt a little too self-indulgent. I didn't want it to be about me, I wanted it to be about my members. And I wanted the name to be something that on its own could almost stand as a mission statement for the club, like a mantra for both student and instructor. As an instructor, it was a constant reminder of what I was trying to create in terms of an environment and in terms of a culture as a gym. I wanted people to feel like they were coming somewhere where warriors go, somewhere to train, somewhere to develop, somewhere to grow, somewhere to work. And I wanted to use it as a tool, in particular with the kids. I teach kids and adults, where I like to use that archetype of a warrior to help them progress. So when it gets a bit hard, when a kid gets a bit upset, when they're struggling, I remind them that they are, through virtue of being here, a warrior. It says it on your t-shirt, kid. You know, it says it on the club door. You are a warrior. So there's a certain way of carrying yourself as a warrior. Warriors push through hard times. Warriors continue to do battle when things get difficult. So that's why I went with Warrior Martial Arts. I appreciate it's generic, but I think, especially with martial arts schools, the focus should be on the quality of the product. As in, teach good classes, be a good instructor, offer a nice environment for people to come train, develop a good culture within your school and within your classes, and everything else kind of falls to the side. The example I use, because a lot of my friends, a lot of people I know will come to me when they're trying to start their own business for advice, because I run my own business. I started it from the ground up, and they want to, you know, they always come with advice. And the first thing they always want to ask is, what do you think of my business's name? What do you think of my logo? What do you think of my branding? And I'm always happy to offer my opinion, but my first thing I always tell them is it's nowhere near as important as you think. The example I always give is Apple computers. Take away everything we know about Apple and tell me why Apple is a good name for a computer company, and why, even if you were going to call it Apple, that your logo would simply be an apple. If I was making a company and we were selling briefcases and I called it Knife and my logo was simply a knife, you'd be perfectly in your right to say that that's not a good name for a briefcase company, has nothing to do with one, and that logo is very generic. But if I made the best briefcases in the world, if I made a good quality product, it wouldn't matter what it was called. And I think that's the thing that I learned from things like, I mean, you could take any brand, Apple, Adidas, Nike, these big brands, they're not really big because they've got a great name. They have a great name now. They have a notoriety because of the product, because of what they offer. That's my stance on it. Naming of the podcast. Thank you again for listening. This week, I want to talk a little bit about traditional martial arts, which is often referred to as TMA for short, just to save me saying traditional martial arts every time. We are going to start with a video I made last week on the YouTube channel. This video was titled, Kata is Useless, Why I Practice It Every Day. Now, I knew in making this video and in titling it that it was going to ruffle some feathers. I intentionally shared it on a karate Reddit page. I intentionally pushed it out to my community, some of which practice kata. So I understood that in doing so, it was likely that it was going to receive a bit of kickback. And I was prepared for that. I think it's important for us to have opinions and not to always feel the need to sit squarely on the fence and always try to make everybody happy. I think we can say when we don't think things work and when we don't think things are good. And I think that makes it more interesting, especially if then someone comes back with a counter argument for why they feel the other way. Now we're having a conversation, and that's a good thing. Doesn't need to become an argument, doesn't need to get petty, but we can have a discussion. And I think that's really part of how martial arts in particular evolves. It's how it grows, it's how it develops. It's a beautiful part of it. So let's encourage it. I made this video and I got a comment on YouTube, and I have no issue, by the way, with this isn't even a trolling comment, in all fairness to this guy, but I have no issue. I understand that if you're going to put content out in public domain, that you are open to criticism and ridicule. You should be, and you need to have thick enough skin to handle that and be able to separate yourself. I received this comment, and I just saw it as I went through my notifications. It was this huge just block of text, just a lump of text, no paragraphing, no nothing. And at the time I was like, you know what? It looks like it's going to be a rant and I just can't be bothered. So I came back to it a few days later when I was in a bit more of a receptive mood, and I read through it. I'm going to share the comment with you guys. I suggest before, maybe go pause this, go watch that video, come back, just so that you get some context of what we're talking about here. But let me give you the short version of that video in case you can't be bothered to do that. You're listening right now. The short version of this video was that I said, I believe katas are useless for teaching you how to fight. They won't prepare you for a fighting scenario, but I still think they have their merit in training because I think they're like an active meditation, similar to like doing yoga. It's a way to move your body, practice your technique, go through the motions of your martial art with very little impact on your joints, zero risk of injury through concussion or taking a shot. And it's a very enjoyable physical meditation. I get a lot of benefits from it. That's why I continue to practice it. But I have never and do never consider it to be a tool for teaching you how to fight. Short version. Here's the comment. This video is pretty clickbaity, mate, and contradictory as well. If it is a teaching tool for techniques, then how come it doesn't teach you how to fight? Granted, if you solely do kata and don't practice bunkai, I mean good realistic bunkai, as in practicing the techniques with a resisting partner, not that choreographed stuff you see in WKF tournaments, and yes, it's pretty useless. Also, most techniques in kata won't even be legal in combat. Of course, you won't become a better kickboxer practicing kata and even bunkai, because you cannot apply groin grabs, eye gouges, joint locks, and whatnot in the ring. Neither can you apply those techniques in WKF tournaments, not even in Kyokushin tournaments, although they are full contact. Hell, even in MMA, you cannot apply a lot of kata techniques because even in the cage, they would be illegal. Ask Peter Yan or John Jones. So if you are training to become a better fighter, just train Kion. No kata needed for that. If you are training karate as an actual martial art, not the watered down versions of it, aka sport, kata is essential. No amount of Kion or Kumite style sparring with other practitioners will ever prepare you for a street fight. It will certainly benefit you, no doubt. But if kata is useless or not essential, comes down to why are you training karate? What are you preparing for? Is it a consensual or non-consensual fight? There's a huge difference. You might want to revise the title and make it a bit more specific. There's a lot to unpack here. I don't want the whole podcast to be about this. So I'm just going to reply to the main points. The guy was relatively polite. I don't think he was having a go to an extent. I disagree with almost everything he says. And I do so in a respectful way. So, sorry, did I get his name? Raul, thank you for your comment. And I respectfully disagree. And I'm going to respectfully give you my response. Not as to get into an argument with you, but just so we can have, like I said, a conversation. The video is pretty clickbaity, as in the title. I don't know about clickbaity. It's intentionally enticing in the sense that you make a bold statement like karate is useless. That is going to draw some attention, especially from karate practitioners. And if you then contradict what you just said by saying, but I still practice it every day, well, now you're sparking people's curiosity. And I think if you've done any marketing of any kind, you understand that that's all that is. All I'm trying to do there is I'm trying to spark your interest. Well, if it's useless, why does he practice it all the day? I guess you'll have to click the video and find out. Let's have a discussion about it. I don't think I was being clickbaity because I say, and I try to always be very upfront in my videos. Like if you watch the first minute of my videos, you'll get the hint. And then I go into details for those of you that enjoy the detail. And I said at the very start of the video, I don't think it's effective for fighting, but I still do it. And here are the reasons why. Now, he goes on to say that it's contradictory. And in particular, he points to the fact that I said that if it's a good tool for teaching technique, how comes it doesn't teach you how to fight? And this, for me, is actually the key point that maybe I didn't make clear in the original video. To which case, thank you for Raul for giving me the opportunity to expand on what I meant. When we teach people to fight in my club, and this is our philosophy and framework, the baseline is conditioning and technique, aka be fit enough to perform the sport for the given duration of time or to perform the fight for the duration of time and learn the given techniques that you would need. The punches, the kicks, etc. Okay? It's a baseline. Now, on top of that baseline, think of it like a pyramid. We then get to the more advanced principles that are movement and distance, timing, and situational understanding. Movement and distance let's start with technique again. Let's say we are doing a sidekick. Yeah, kick to the body with the bottom of your foot driving through into your opponent's stomach. You've developed your sidekick to the point where if it kicks someone, they will be obliterated into a million pieces of dust. Yeah, they will be shot into the next dimension. Best sidekick ever. But if you haven't trained it with an understanding of movement and distance, as in how close do you need to be to hit someone with this kick? What do you do if someone moves backwards, moves left, moves right, crowds you? How do you manage the distance between you and another person to ensure that you are in the right position to land the kick? This cannot be practiced through kata. Kata is on your own. Kata is done through set techniques through a set space. It has no consideration for moving targets or resistance. Now, in all fairness to Raul, he goes on to talk about bunkai and kions. Effectively, what we're talking about here, for anyone who's not familiar with the vernacular, is partnered katas, partnered techniques. In the world of sports martial arts, we just refer to this as drilling. Drills, which I mentioned in the video, is an essential part of actually learning how to fight. Sparring drills and sparring. These things are what you need to be doing because they take into consideration distance management and they take into consideration timing, when to throw the technique, when to lift the leg, when is the right moment that when you lift that leg, they're going to move their guard in the right position for you to land that shot. Okay? He goes on to talk about and this is where karate practitioner, traditional TMA martial artists get in trouble because they start talking about things like groin grabs, eye gouges, joint locks, which are not permitted. They're too dangerous, okay? Street fighting techniques. And again, I'll go as far as saying that these things actually need to be practiced to be effective. It's all well and good saying you understand how to eye gouge someone, because it's a basic idea, right? Take your thumbs, stick them in the eyeballs. But I spoke last week about self-defense and how you don't actually know how you're gonna respond in the moment. And more often than not, you're gonna respond in whatever's rehearsed. So if you're trained with wrist locks, like I was, that's what you just default to. No conscious thinking, you just default to your training. But if all you've ever done is in thin air go like this, to simulate an eye gouge, because obviously we can't eye gouge each other, I very much doubt that's going to come out in a street fight situation. Raul got a little bit muddled in the weeds, differentiating between fight, as in, are we talking about street fighting self-defense? Are we talking about competition? And if we're talking about competition, what are we discussing? MMA, what rule set are we working in? He goes on, his final part, and then I'm going to move on. He goes on to talk about watered down versions. And this is another argument that traditional martial arts will use. And again, I'm talking as someone who practices traditional martial arts. They will say that what you're learning now is watered down from what it used to be. Do you know why it's watered down? Because it used to be a sport of real self-defense where people would get hurt in training. People would get their arms broken. People would get their eyes gouged, their groins grabbed, and they would keep going because it was to learn to defend their land, their way of being, their way of life. Nowadays, you'll get sued if you do that because guess what? People have jobs. People have places to be after training. They're doing it for recreational purposes. Martial arts has had to evolve. It's the reason why I've gone down a real rabbit hole recently of Lefway, which is bare knuckle Burmese boxing, which is effectively Muay Thai, but bare knuckle and with headbutts. Think of Muay Thai as the safer version. Can you believe I'm saying that? The safer version of Lefway. Take out the headbutts, put the gloves on people, and introduce a scoring system so that you don't have to knock out your opponent to win. In Lefway, the only way to win is via stoppage. You must stop your opponent or it's a draw if it gets to the end of the fight. So Muay Thai introduced principles to make the sport safer. Now it's still elbow and kneeing people in the head. It's not safe by any means, but safer than what Lefway was. Karate has had to change massively from what it originally was because now kids are practicing it. Mums are practicing it. Dads are practicing it. It's not the same. Okay, but if my opinion, many TMA clubs have gone too far down that route to the point where they're not sparring enough and they're not, this is the word I like to use, this is the word you'll see a lot, they're not pressure testing enough. They're not putting themselves in those uncomfortable situations in sparring where you find out what works and what doesn't. There's a reason that people always say the basics win fights. It's because the basics have been pressure tested over and over again. How many fights do you see won by a spinning hook kick, spinning wheel kick? Small handful. How many fights do you see won by a basic back leg roundhouse kick to the head? hundreds of thousands, right? That kick universally has knocked out more people than probably any other head kick ever thrown. It's a basic technique. You'll learn it on day one, provided you have the flexibility to get your leg up there. And it's a very simple fundamental movement. There's not a lot to it. You get your leg, you rotate your hip, you bring your foot, you connect it with their head, KO. The reason it's effective is it's simple and it's been pressure tested again and again and again. And the people throwing it have an understanding of distance management, timing, and situational awareness via sparring, drills, and competition. Raul, thank you for your comment. I appreciate it. I appreciate the conversation. I stand by everything I said, and I hope you can respectfully disagree if you need to, or hopefully maybe you've learned something. Let's move on. Staying with the idea of traditional martial arts, this whole thing extended to get me thinking about gradings. Belt systems. What are their value? Is there any value? Is there any point? Are they a con? Should you partake? What about sports that don't include them? So let's talk a little bit about belt systems. I like to be transparent from the start when I talk on topics that are in any way related to me. So I will be transparent from the start in saying I run a freestyle kickboxing school and we do have a grading system. Now, this is not unique to me. And just a little, I meant to do this in episode one, a little background, a little history on freestyle kickboxing. I'll keep this brief. Freestyle kickboxing, and if you have no idea what I'm talking about, if you're like, what are you even saying? Think Stephen Wonderboy Thompson, Raymond Daniels, Michael Venom Page. That style of fighting is, in my opinion, in my understanding, freestyle kickboxing. Now, you'll often hear to them by commentators and even themselves referred to as karate practitioners, that point fighting karate style. The reason being, if we trace it back, and I'm a good person to talk on this because I'm actually a very similar age to all these guys. I'm in my 30s, similar to Wonderboy, Raymond Daniels, etc. I think Raymond's actually now 40, which is a pretty crazy thing to say. They started as karate practitioners. When they were kids and joined a school, they joined a karate school. Michael Page, actually, a Lagua Kung Fu school, but you'll see how it connects. This would have been with kata, traditional techniques, kions. And then they started looking for ways to compete. And the competition available was what at the time was called sports karate. And sports karate was effectively points fighting, kind of derived from traditional kumite, but think of it a little bit more loose, a little bit more free. And then from that, it developed into light continuous kickboxing, full continuous kickboxing in a ring, think kind of glory kickboxing, and K1, introduction of the knees and a little bit of clinch work mixed in amongst it. But the roots of it were from karate, but it very much is kickboxing. So a lot of these schools adapted their syllabus or provided an alternative syllabus that focused more on kickboxing, more on this competition side, spending less time on kata, kions, because this stuff was ineffective for improving you at this element of the game. So if you wanted to be good at the fighting side, you had to spend more time training drills and sparring. So there's the belt system. We run under WACO, World Association of Kickboxing Organizations. I think I've got that right. I get it wrong all the time, and I do apologize. I should know better being a club under that banner. They recently received full IOC, International Olympic Committee recognition. So well done to WACO, making big moves for the sport, developing it and growing it to the next stage. Clap, clap, clap. And belt systems are a thing. Okay, belt systems within these disciplines are a thing. Where you won't see belt systems are in Muay Thai most of the time. Wrestling, boxing. Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, no gi, is very often not with a belt system. And if you train both, you'll very often hear people saying the reason he hasn't got his next belt yet is because he hasn't spent enough time in the gi, not enough time practicing the traditional element. So let's go through whether or not belt systems are something worth having. The way I'm going to approach this is by playing devil's advocate to myself and bringing up some of the common reasons, complaints that I hear for why belts are not worth doing, having. Reason number one is that a belt doesn't mean anything about how good you are, that your ability should speak for itself, your performance should speak for itself. A great example of this I'm going to use, it comes from Chael Sonnen, ex-UFC fighter. If you're a fan, you'll know him as Uncle Chael. And Chael speaks very openly about his time with Team Quest. Team Quest was his gym, as in his training gym, with Randy Couture, one of the greats pioneers for the UFC. And he talks about the original name for Team Quest, which was Performance Quest. Terrible name. But the reason for that name, very similar to what I was talking about warrior martial arts in terms of having it part of the mantra of what you stand for, Team Performance Quest didn't have any belt system, although they practiced jiu-jitsu and kickboxing and all these things where there might be a belt system present. Their focus was on performance. Your rank, your ability was reflected in how well you did in competition. Everything they did was focused towards making you a UFC or whatever, Bellator, world champion. If you got the belt, that was your belt. Yeah, the gold belt, the 12-pound gold belt. Not a black belt, not a brown belt, not a blue belt. Great way of doing it. No complaints. What it doesn't account for is the full-time mums, is the kid at school, is the guy who works 6 days a week and gets to exercise or feels like he can fit in exercise 3 times a week. What about these guys? Because they're not going to become UFC champions. A lot of them, actually have no interest in fighting whatsoever, but they're still interested in martial arts. They still want to learn how to kick and punch. They still want to learn the technique. They enjoy the idea of it. What can they have to gauge their process against, their progress against? And this is where I think a belt system has a lot of validity. It provides a sense of progression. It gives you something to work on. It gives you something to work towards. A belt system allows you to structure your training and effectively have SMART goals, intelligent SMART goals. You're one of these mums, full-time mum. You've tried going to the gym, as in the regular weightlifting treadmill gym, and you found it uninteresting. You got bored after a few months. The reason people struggle with staying committed to the gym is they find it difficult to engage with the why, because it's too vague. I want to be in better shape. I want to lose weight. I want to gain muscle. This is very difficult. You need to be very clear. And the way you do that is you do SMART goals. Yeah, and if you haven't done this, go type in what a SMART goal is. I'm not going to get into it. But the basic principle is the goal needs to have certain criteria to then be something that you're actually going to achieve. So instead of saying, I want to lose weight, you say, I want to lose 10 pounds of body fat in the next 6 months by training 5 days a week for 1 hour a day and following this diet. You see the difference between I'm trying to lose weight and what I just said? Now, going to a martial arts school that has a grading system tailors that into the training by saying, let's go for an example, I want to get my yellow belt. The grading is in 3 months. So now you have a time period. This is the syllabus that I need to learn. So now you've got a specific list of things, a criteria for what you need to have ready within that time period. This is how often I can train. These are the classes that I will be attending. I need to be regularly committed to these classes to ensure I have enough time to absorb this syllabus and be prepared for the date that is set at the end of the 3 months to take my grading. Now, for those of you that fight, that's replaced with, there's a fight in 3 months. This is the person I'm fighting. I've got this amount of time to prepare. They're kicking dominant, so I need to prepare for that in particular in this situation. Let's go. But this lady doesn't want to fight. She's not interested. But she's now still got something she can work towards rather than just coming to the gym and just training. Nothing wrong with it for a lot of people. It's just training is enough. You know, they come, they train and do whatever the coach says and they walk out of the room happy, great. But for some people, having that goal really helps structure it. We see this the most with the kids. Kids need these constant little goals. It's why you see martial arts schools do stripe tape. And it's this stupid electric tape that we just wrap around their belts. And you're like, what does that mean? I got stripe tape at home. I'll go put some tape on the belt. Doesn't mean anything. It does mean something. The meaning is carried over to what we put on it. Yeah, a belt is a belt. A uniform is a uniform. Gold is a metal. We provide meaning to things. We provide value to things. So what that stripe represents is progress. And it's a recognition of your progress. It's congratulations. You learned this. Here's a stripe. You're one step closer to your bigger goal, the next belt. In that sense, I think belts are really useful. You fall in a trap. The trap occurs where people get a black belt and the journey comes to the end. They get the black belt and they're like, well, completed it. Yeah, martial arts complete. As we know, the majority of your learning actually happens after your black belt. That's where you gained a baseline of knowledge. You've got the fundamental understanding of what the martial art is. And now it's like you're doing a dissertation beyond that, your PhD, where you now need to put your own spin on it. Provide your piece, the way you give back. A lot of the, you know, Dan gradings, you'll see people with the gold stripes on their belts. That's not necessarily, and it's not, about learning more, or they did more black belt gradings. It's actually more about what have you done for the sport? What have you given back? A Dan gradings get awarded because you've run tournaments, because you've taught 500 students. You know, they get given because you are now part of that teaching and growing process of the martial art. And it's a recognition of your achievements and your contribution to your martial art. Let's move on. The other big argument for why belts are no good is that it's a cash grab. That martial arts schools use belt systems as a way of injecting payment into the club. It's very true. It's very, very true. But so is anything that's going to provide monetary value. You're actually talking more about people than you are martial arts here. It's called greed. I run a martial arts school. It's my main source of income. I do it partly down with the intention of making a profit. The same way a musician, although they love what they do, they go and play the gigs, play the weddings, play the bars to get paid. Profit, not just cover their costs, but to profit so they can feed their family, pay their bills, live their life. It's fair, isn't it? A photographer enjoys photography. But they go to weddings and take photos of other people's happy day with the intention of being paid for their time. Now, martial art instructors, we run classes. You pay to come to our classes. If we run gradings, which are a separate event, normally on a weekend, where we get people in, additional hands, you rent the space, use the space, whatever, present the belts, present the certificates, there's A, going to be a charge to cover the cost of running that. And I don't think we as a community should have to apologize for making a little profit on it. Now, of course, this is where it gets hazy because the amount of profit you choose to make is personal to you. there are people out there who are greedy. Huge markup, very expensive gradings. I'm talking hundreds and hundreds of pounds. Very regular gradings, as in every month you're getting a new belt. And for some reason, there's 25 belts. Now you're being greedy. Now it's not about goals. It's not about standards. It's about how can we hemorrhage people for as much money as possible constantly, as well as their training fees. How can we get them basically monthly giving us something else? That's what it becomes about. But that's nothing to do with martial arts. It's someone taking advantage of a system that's in place, right? The belt system is there. It's a way of people to progress. It is a way for a club to make some additional profit. And I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing, as long as it's done with a conscious effort to not take the piss, right? But it can be taken advantage of. It can be manipulated, as can anything else that you monetize. It's very easy to do. So I think that should come to you to educate yourself to a point where when it comes to searching for a martial arts school, and here's some advice to you, ask about these things. Ask about the grading system. How many belts are there? How often are the gradings? Is it compulsory? My students don't need to grade. None of them. They don't need to do it. My adults don't need to wear their belts during class. They can just train and just come and enjoy my classes. And if that's what you want, perfect. But there's the option to grade if you want something to work towards and you have no interest in the competitive side of the sport. Do I think that a black belt who doesn't compete versus a black belt who does compete are the same? No. You'll see that all the time. BJJ refer to this as competition black belts. And it's like you get two black belts, both have gone through the same school, both have got their black belt at around the same time, but this guy, this gal, competes. Gonna whoop this one's butt. And it comes back to that conversation we had earlier about the video about kata. It's application and pressure testing. They've learnt the same stuff, but this guy, this girl, has put it under pressure, put it in a condition where it can be tested, be pushed, be refined, and be developed to a point where it's far more effective. Not all black belts are the same. The problem is that people think that black belt is this blanket term for a master at martial arts, that now suddenly you're invulnerable, you can't be beat, don't mess with him, he's a black belt. You don't know what that means anymore. You never really have, but it doesn't. The black belt on its own is a great achievement. You should be very proud because it means that you've committed a huge amount of your time and energy in order to achieve it. At least it should. Again, some schools will take advantage. Black belts at 9 years old, yeah? You're not a black belt. You're just a shill. You've just paid out a ton of money to get given a belt. The value of that belt does not carry over. You know, it's not gold. It's not silver. It's not bronze. You've got, I don't know what a cheap metal is, but you got cheap metal. It's copper in comparison to gold. The value is diminished. I've thrown myself off my trail of thought. I think that means I've said all I need to say. I think you get the idea. I think belt systems have a place. I don't think they're necessary. Let's make that clear. Let's go back to that. Boxing doesn't have one. Wrestling doesn't have one. Muay Thai doesn't have one. And there's nothing wrong with that. I would just go as far as saying it doesn't mean that because other martial arts do have them, that they lack value. I think the reason we see them lacking value or being underappreciated or less appreciated is, take the UFC, which is, I always refer to the UFC because it's the largest martial art organization in the world in the sense that it's got the most eyes on it. Yeah. People who enjoy Taekwondo are probably more people than enjoy the UFC in terms of participation, right? There's more people training Taekwondo in the world than training MMA, I would argue. I'm pretty sure on that one. Same for karate. But in terms of the general worldwide audience, who do you know who doesn't train martial arts, who watches Taekwondo tournaments or karate tournaments or jiu-jitsu tournaments? They don't. but I bet you they'll watch Conor McGregor on the UFC. So it gets the eyes of the average person. And when they see that, what they will generally see is Muay Thai practitioners, which is widely adopted as the main style of striking to adopt for MMA because it's the closest in the sense of what's permitted. Elbows, knees, clinching. It relates well to the rule set. Wrestling, which allows you to dictate whether the fight take place on the feet or on the floor, which is a huge part because if you're fighting someone who's very good at striking, but you have wrestling, you can put them on the floor and nullify it. If you're fighting someone who's very good at jiu-jitsu, aka submission fighting, you can use your wrestling to stop them taking it to the floor and force them into a striking battle that maybe they're more uncomfortable with. And what we spoke about earlier with no-gi jiu-jitsu, which doesn't follow the same belt progression often as gi jiu-jitsu. It does sometimes, but not always. You see these three sports and they're widely represented and you say, well, surely if these are the most effective ones, then that shows that belt systems are no use, no good. But again, I go back to my point of the mum. Not everyone is training to become a UFC fighter. If you want to become the most effective fighter, fine. We can argue then that MMA with a focus on Muay Thai, wrestling and no-gi jiu-jitsu is the best route to do that, including in things like being able to defend yourself as best as possible. But I spoke last week about the one time I had to defend myself, and I defended myself with what at the time was a bit of bullshido, but it was just what I was taught. Luckily, the guy knew even less than I did, and I managed to pull it off. So it's just not as black and white as everyone likes to say. This is good, this is bad. There's a lot more color to it. Get it? Belts, color. That's my two cents on it, guys. That's my opinion on it. I think belt systems are fine. I think they can be taken advantage of. I don't think you need to grade. I don't think people should put too much emphasis on it or make it too much of a big deal. The last thing I'll say on it is, especially take, for example, my club's black belt grading. It's a two-day weekend course, and we try to crush you. You know, we not as in just like beat on you and give you a concussion, but we work you. We make you do untold amounts of fitness, pad work, bag work, drilling, so that at the end of the 2 days, when we finally tell you you're done, there's a huge sense of elation and achievement because you've come through a challenge. The same way fighters, when they come through a tough fight and get the win, you see them, they raise their hands in the air, they're overcome with happiness to the point of crying. I've seen those same emotions from full-time mums who have made the time to work towards and achieve their black belt in a given martial art. And I think that that's a beautiful thing. I think that's a wonderful thing. The one thing I make clear to this mum, and she'll always know it, is she's not going to go win in the UFC now. She can't jump in there with Amanda Nunes and whoop her butt because she's not specifically trained for that. But she's achieved something. She's learned something. She does have a fundamental understanding or good understanding of how to punch, how to kick, how to block, how to move. And all of that is going to vary from school to school, depending on the quality of your tuition, which I can't comment on. We try our best, as I'm sure everyone else does. You know what you know. If you're curious like me, you're always trying to extend your knowledge. And I hope that most martial arts schools and clubs and instructors are always trying to develop. That's as far as I'll go on it. For next week's episode, just as a preview for any of you that have stuck around this long, thank you for listening so much. I plan to discuss gym cancers. Gym cancers was a term that I heard from a guy who does a jiu-jitsu podcast called Chew-Jitsu. Check him out, Chewy, on YouTube. I'll try to remember to link him below, but no promises. And he does a brilliant podcast. He'd done a great episode where he discussed this guy who was a gym cancer. He was a bad training partner, not a nice guy, and how he had to remove him from the gym, had to get rid of him. So I thought that'd be an interesting thing to discuss. Maybe some of my previous experiences, maybe my thoughts on bad training partners and all the rest of it. But please let me know in the comment section what you'd like me to talk about. What would you be interested to hearing about? And we can branch out as wide as we like. This is an open book. Like I said, guys, I'm in the process of figuring out what I want this all to be. So please be part of that by letting me know. What do you want to hear about? Training regimes, techniques, more history of different martial arts, stories, top threes, recommendations. You tell me. I am here to serve you. Guys, thank you for listening. Hit the like button. If you're listening to us on a podcast platform and it gives you the opportunity to leave a review, please leave a nice review. I really appreciate it. Thank you for listening, and I will see you on the next one.